So, good afternoon to you all. In the absence of Dean Jeffries, who's unable to be with us this afternoon, I have the pleasant task of welcoming you to the 2007 Metter Lecture on Law and Religion and introducing you to our speaker and a longtime friend of this law school, Professor William Stuntz. Before I introduce Professor Stuntz, I want to say something about the lecture itself, the Metter Lecture. The lecture was inaugurated in 1997 to mark the retirement of Professor Daniel J. Metter from the University of Virginia Law Faculty. It was designed to promote the interdisciplinary study of law and religion. The lecture was endowed through the gifts of friends and students of Professor Metter and also alumni of the law school. Professor Metter taught at the law school for some 30 years and was the first director of our graduate program for judges. He's an expert on federal courts and judicial reform and has written or co-authored 9 books, numerous law review articles, and 3 novels, which is kind of fun. We're honored to have Professor Metter in our audience this afternoon. Professor Metter, welcome. And now to our speaker. Professor William Stuntz is the Henry J. Friendly Professor of Law and the Vice Dean for Intellectual Life at Harvard Law School. He's the author of over 30 law review articles, a leading casebook on criminal procedure, and numerous articles and columns in the popular press. Professor Stuntz's work focuses on various aspects of what he calls America's unsystematic criminal justice system. He's written influential articles on the law of search and seizure, Miranda doctrine, and the relationship between criminal law and criminal procedure. His most recent articles explore the politics of criminal justice, focusing on the relationship between state and federal actors and how the relative powers of prosecutors, courts, and legislators interact to shape criminal law and procedure. He's also written about how the events of 9/11 and the war on terror have affected policing and criminal prosecutions. Professor Stuntz is currently working on a book about the past and future of criminal justice, which will be published by Harvard University Press early next year. In recent years, Professor Stuntz has become interested in the relationship between religion and law. His articles on this topic include a piece in Harvard Law Review entitled Christian Legal Theory and a co-authored article published in the University of Pennsylvania Journal of Constitutional Law entitled Christianity and the Modest Rule of Law. His most recent work explores the role of religion in the development of criminal laws of vice. One of the things I've always loved about Professor Stuntz's academic work, which I've been reading for years, is that he has an eye for new and innovative ways of looking at old topics and old problems, but unlike some of the law review literature, he does this while keeping his theories close enough to the ground that they speak not only to the academy, but to folks like many of you who are actually going to be applying the law in the real world. Professor Stuntz grew up in Annapolis, Maryland, near the water, which he tells me he continues to love. He earned a BA in History and English from the College of William and Mary in 1980 and his JD from the University of Virginia School of Law in 1984. Before entering teaching, Stuntz served as a law clerk to Justice Lewis H. Pollack on the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania and for Justice Lewis F. Powell on the Supreme Court of the United States. In 1986, he returned to the University of Virginia Law School where he taught for 14 years. Professor Stuntz has been at the Harvard Law School since 2000 and has also been a visiting professor at Yale Law School and a lecturer at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. Those of us who knew Bill Stuntz during the years that he spent with us here at the law school remember him with deep admiration and affection. He was a very popular teacher and a wonderful colleague. Bill was known for wandering the halls looking for somebody to talk to. He would pop into colleagues' offices to talk about his work and theirs. He was also a great favorite at weekly faculty workshops. He always asked great probing questions and contributed to lively discussion. Bill was also strikingly generous with his younger colleagues. He would read and comment on their work and encourage them in their scholarship. Bill has an unusual capacity to help colleagues write the article they want to write, rather than, as some of us are wont to do, pressing others to write the article we want to write. I want to tell you two personal stories about Bill in his younger days at UVA. When Bill applied to UVA Law School, he didn't get in on the first go-round. Can you believe we put him on the waiting list? So when he got in the next year, he quickly demonstrated the depths of our bad judgment by graduating at the very top of his class and then returning to teach law at the tender age of something like 26 or 27. As many of you remember, when Bill started teaching law, he looked about 12. So his strategy when he came to Charlottesville was to grow a beard. And that was to convince his students that he was old enough to actually say something of value that they would want to listen to in the classroom. But that was a while ago. Today, Bill is one of the most gifted scholars of criminal justice in the country, and he's a thoroughly wonderful colleague. Bill, I know I speak for all your colleagues here at the law school when I say how very pleased we are to welcome you back to present the 2007 Metter Lecture on Law and Religion, which is entitled Law and Grace. Please join me in welcoming to the podium Professor Bill Stuntz.
Thank you very much. You know, the beard didn't work, and I've never really been quite sure why I kept it, but I did. So I want to thank Barb Armacost for that lovely introduction and unduly generous introduction, and I want to thank Barb and this institution for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. This is a great privilege for me. I have loved this place since I started law school here 26 years ago, and I'm sure I will love it all my days. I am very, very grateful for the chance to come back here and to speak here, and I thank all who made that possible. And I want to thank Dan Metter, who is responsible for this lecture series and whose name the lecture bears. To associate my name in any form or fashion with Dan Metter's does Dan no good, but does me great honor. And so, while I feel inadequate to the task, I also feel very grateful. I was planning on introducing my daughter, who's in the audience. She's the one who's slithering under her seat right now. She's sort of back there. I think she's glowing at this point. If I say any more, I will pay a large price for it afterwards, so I'll pass on that. Down to business. The subject of this lecture is the relationship between two metaphorical wars that have defined American politics and American law over the last generation: the culture war and the war on crime, especially drug crime. Aside from the fact that these two non-wars have been misnamed, they seem to have little in common. One is about abortion and gay rights. The other is about crack and crystal meth. The key actors in the first are Supreme Court justices and religious right politicians. The key actors in the second are big city prosecutors and members of urban gangs. There doesn't really seem to be much overlap here. Actually, I think there's a lot of overlap here. Twice in American history, theologically conservative Protestants have been a stable voting bloc, meaning we've seen two historical periods when the most Protestant parts of the country voted together and voted differently from the rest of the country. The first of those periods began in the 1890s and lasted until the 1930s. The second began in the 1970s and lasted at least until the re-election of George W. Bush 3 years ago. Remember those dates and think about these. Twice in American history, this country's prison population has exploded. Beginning in the 1890s and running through the late 1930s, the prison population, the imprisonment rate, that is, the percentage of the population that lives behind bars, more than doubled. Between the mid-1970s and today, the imprisonment rate quintupled. Seems like an interesting coincidence, but there's more. In the 140 years since the Civil War ended, the United States has seen two large-scale legal crusades against vice. The first began in 1890 with the passage of the federal law banning the mailing of lottery tickets. Federal and state laws targeting gambling, prostitution, drugs, and alcohol followed over the next few decades. This long crusade ended when Prohibition ended in 1933. The second of these anti-vice crusades began in 1973. As some of you may remember, that was the year Roe v. Wade was decided. It was also the year Nelson Rockefeller signed into law New York's new drug statute, which inaugurated the drug war. The pro-life movement took off a few years later. Two generation-long culture wars and two generation-long battles against vice coincided with two generation-long explosions in the nation's prison population. The common thread in all the trends I've just mentioned is the political power of a religious community, my religious community. I'm an evangelical Christian. I belong to a theologically conservative Protestant church. I hate the word conservative in this context, but that's the customary term, so I'll use it. People who belong to churches like mine, meaning mostly white, theologically conservative, or orthodox Protestants, have been a powerful voting bloc for the last generation, as was the case for the first generation of the 20th century. In between, not so much. America's criminal justice system has become vastly more punitive during the last generation as it did during the first generation of the 20th century. In between, not so much. I want to ask and take a stab at answering four questions about those two sets of trends. First, what is the relationship between them? Second, why should that relationship seem surprising? Third, why does this surprising relationship exist? Why did things happen the way they did? And fourth, how might things have happened differently? Those are the questions. Here's a quick tour of the answers. America's justice system is more punitive in large part because voters in church communities like mine supported policies and politicians who made it so. That relationship should seem strange because my faith and the faith of the large majority of evangelical Protestants in the United States and elsewhere emphasizes grace and mercy, not rules and punishments. Christians of my generation and of some past generations embraced punitive policies because those policies did not seem that punitive at the time. We didn't mean to be unfaithful to our faith. It didn't seem that way at the time. Nothing turned out the way anyone thought it would. Last question, how might it all have been different? The short answer is, we might have fought a different kind of culture war and a different kind of crime war, one that was less warlike, one that produced many fewer casualties. Here's the surprising and sad part of that story. That other, less warlike kind of war would have been a great deal more successful than the wars we actually fought. Okay, that's the Cliff's Notes version of the lecture. I'm tempted to say you can all go now, but Barb would be displeased. So I'll say a little more about each of my four answers, and then I'll stop and let you ask the questions. Begin with the first question. What is the relationship between these two culture wars and these two explosions in America's prison population? My claim is that theologically conservative Protestants either triggered the rise in punishment or made it more extreme than it otherwise would have been. What's the evidence for that claim? Well, in part, some of the coincidences that I've already mentioned, but there is more. Both in the generation after 1890 and in our own generation, imprisonment rose the most in the most Protestant parts of the country, the places we call the Bible Belt. Both times, the politicians who were the most popular with evangelical Protestants, William Jennings Bryan and Franklin D. Roosevelt in the earlier period, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush in the later one, were prominent practitioners of tough-on-crime politics. That may not be something that you know about Bryan and FDR from your college history classes, but it's as true of them as it is of Reagan and Bush. Both times, anti-vice crusades fueled the growth in the nation's inmate population. And both times, voters in the Protestant parts of the country were the political backbone of those anti-vice crusades. There are differences, obvious ones, between the two periods. A century ago, theologically conservative Protestants leaned to the political left, and their favorite politicians were Democrats. In our own time, voters in church communities like mine have leaned to the right and mostly voted Republican. But the religious left of a century ago and the religious right of our own time are more similar than different, I believe. The key similarity is that both movements sought to use law and government primarily as a means of condemning and punishing moral wrongs. That led naturally to punitive politics and to a more punitive justice system. So American law and American politics turned sharply more punitive. At the same time, voters in church communities, communities like mine, became a much more powerful voting bloc. And that happened not once, but twice. Could it be a coincidence? Yes. Does it seem likely that it's a coincidence? I don't think so. My church community is not solely responsible, not remotely solely responsible, for the two punitive turns that America's justice system has taken in the last 120 years, but I suspect we made both of those punitive turns much more punitive than they otherwise would have been. Which leads to the second question. Why should that proposition seem strange? Well, right at the outset, it wouldn't seem strange to a lot of people. People outside my church community tend to see people inside that community as intolerant, nasty busybodies. Of course, prison populations rise when people like that exercise political power. It's the most natural thing in the world. Only it isn't the most natural thing in the world. If you look at the long history of English and American criminal law, it does not support the proposition that Christians tend to make justice systems more punitive. More the opposite. Christians and Christianity made English and early American criminal justice more lenient and more libertarian. The last 120 years have been the exception, not the rule. That isn't my argument, at least not for the most part. It rightly belongs to Jim Whitman, a legal historian at Yale, and probably the best legal historian in the United States, who doesn't live in or near Charlottesville. Perhaps one of the few legal historians in the United States who doesn't live in or near Charlottesville, but that's another subject. Whitman has a new book about to come out titled The Origins of Reasonable Doubt, Theological Roots of the Criminal Trial. It's not the catchiest title I've ever heard, but it's actually a great book. Here is Whitman's story. In the centuries before American independence, English criminal justice faced a crisis. The justice system couldn't punish enough people. Most criminals were unconvictable. Christian judges and jurors worshipped a savior who was himself the victim of wrongful criminal punishment, and they feared damnation if they convicted defendants wrongfully themselves or if they convicted defendants notwithstanding doubts about their guilt. The beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which we see as a limit on criminal punishment, was actually designed to encourage criminal punishment by reassuring Christian jurors that they could vote to convict without sending themselves to hell. Whitman's story is powerful and utterly persuasive. I won't try and summarize it here, but I do want to note that its power extends well beyond burden of proof doctrine. English criminal law and early American criminal law were much more libertarian than we usually suppose, and much more libertarian than the state and federal criminal codes that govern Americans today. Save for murder, violent felonies, and felony thefts were all defined more narrowly two centuries ago than they are today. Most of the vice crimes and regulatory crimes that fill American criminal codes did not exist in centuries past. The reason for the difference is the sensibility Whitman describes. Christian lawmakers, judges, and jurors were wary of criminal punishment, not eager to impose it. The same wariness fits naturally with the religious beliefs held by most people in church communities like mine. If there is one New Testament story that lies at the heart of evangelical Protestant culture today, it's the story of the prodigal son. Probably everyone here knows the tale. The younger of two sons demands his share of the father's estate while the father still lives. The father gives the son what he asks, and the son proceeds to squander the money, indulging every imaginable vice along the way. When he's at the end of his rope, the prodigal decides to return home and beg his father to let him work as one of his hired hands. He doesn't dare ask to be taken back into the household as a son. When the prodigal is on the road toward his father's house, when he is yet far off, the Bible says, the father runs out to greet him. The son starts begging. I think we're to believe that the son has prepared a speech that he's beginning to deliver. And the father cuts him off and tells his servants, bring my best robe, bring sandals for his feet, put my family's ring on his finger, kill the best calf, prepare the best food and wine. We're going to have a party, for my son was lost and now is found. Then the story takes a surprising turn. Attention shifts from the prodigal to the father's other son, the older brother, who didn't run away and squander his share of the estate, the dutiful son who remained loyal and did as he was told. That older son objects to the father's generosity. He says, in effect, why waste your wealth on my no-good brother? Sentiments those of us with brothers can readily understand. Why not throw this party for me, he says. And when the story ends, the status of the two brothers has been reversed. It's the prodigal who is now the member in good standing of his father's household, and it's the dutiful older brother who is now estranged from that household. I'm going to ask an odd question. What lessons does that story teach about law and politics and government? It is an odd question. It sounds like a lunatic question. The story is about salvation. It's not about law and politics at all. Those things have nothing to do with it. But I think the story works only if, at some level, it's plausible, only if we could imagine real flesh and blood human beings behaving like this with these results. And if it is plausible, if ordinary human interactions work this way, at least sometimes, there probably are implications for the government policies and legal rules that govern those ordinary human interactions. So bear with me. I think two implications are key. One about grace, one about judgment. We aren't told what happens to the prodigal after he returns to his father's household, but the story clearly invites you to believe that he's a changed man, a far better and larger and more decent human being at the story's end than at its beginning. What changed him? The answer is his father's embrace. The father has every right to punish him, every right to banish him, the way we might banish a criminal to a penitentiary. But he doesn't do that. Instead, he gives his wayward son an incredibly valuable gift, more valuable than his share of the inheritance, a restored relationship. The robe, the sandals, the ring, the party are the tangible manifestations of that incredibly valuable gift. Mercy plus relationship with a party thrown in for good measure. That's a pretty good working definition of grace. When that kind of grace happens, the story seems to say, lives are changed. There is some reason to believe that principle applies, at least sometimes, in this world, not just in the next. Take two examples from the recent past. In the 1960s, abortion was a crime in all 50 states, and the number of abortions soared. In the last 25 years, abortion has been a constitutional right, again, in all 50 states, and the abortion rate has fallen 30%. Among teenage girls, the drop is close to 40%. What explains that odd pattern? One answer is the several thousand crisis pregnancy centers that pro-life churches and organizations have founded in the last 25 years. Those centers lack the power to punish or coerce, but they seem to have the power to change lives, not with rules and threats, but with mercy and relationship. Notice, the pro-life movement has enjoyed its greatest success when its tactics have been most grace-like. The other example comes from the gritty world of urban crime. In the 1990s and the early part of this decade, we saw a combination of three trends that surprised a lot of people. They certainly surprised me. More police officers on city streets, fewer arrests. People in my field tend to assume that when you hire more cops, the arrest rate goes up. That did not happen. More police officers on city streets, fewer arrests, and dramatically lower crime rates. Urban police forces reduced crime not by locking up more criminals, but by entering into relationship with the communities they serve, and often with the churches that serve those communities. The best big city police forces today work hard to keep young men out of prison, not to put them there. It succeeds. It's a successful tactic. The jurisdictions that saw the biggest crime drops in the 1990s were the ones that hired the most cops and locked up the fewest criminals. Grace and mercy and relationship are transformative, and that truth has practical value for people who think about law and politics and government. If you doubt that, talk to some big city police chiefs. If mercy and relationship are more powerful than we tend to think, judgment and condemnation are more dangerous than we tend to think. Recall the older son in the story of the prodigal, the one who did what he was supposed to do, yet who ends the story at odds with his father. The people who should most fear for their souls, the story seems to say, are not the rule breakers. Instead, it's the compliant, responsible, law-abiding part of the population, the religious part of the population, the people who keep our noses clean and do what we are supposed to. I'm basically a dutiful son by nature. I'm not sure my parents would say that. Most of my Christian friends are, at heart, dutiful sons and daughters. The prodigal son story teaches people like us to hesitate long and hard before we point fingers at anyone else. It teaches me not to imagine for a moment that I stand in a morally superior position. It teaches all Christians to be wary not of vice and loose living, but of arrogance and self-righteousness. Mine is emphatically not a faith that teaches its adherents that there are moral lines to be drawn, that we're on the right side of them, and that those on the wrong side of them need to be hammered. On the contrary, the God who I worship liked to hang around with prostitutes and tax collectors. The present-day equivalent would be drug dealers and white-collar crooks. My church community ought to be the last group that seeks huge increases in the prison population. Let me put the point another way. If we had seen exactly the opposite of the criminal justice trends of the last 30 years, if criminal punishment had fallen sharply instead of rising stratospherically, and if the decline in punishment seemed somehow tied to the rising power of theologically conservative Protestants, if all those things were true, the odds are no one would find the combination shocking. It would all seem natural and predictable as the behavior of those Christian judges and jurors about whom Jim Whitman writes. The association between Christianity and leniency is not surprising at all. It's historically common and doctrinally reasonable, which means that the association between Christianity and severity, the association we've actually seen in the United States over the last century, should be very surprising indeed. So, third question, why did that surprising association happen? Why did a community whose faith pushes us toward leniency embrace a style of politics that pushed toward severity? In my view, this question is the hardest. I don't have confident answers, but I do have three unconfident ones. First, American Protestants of the last 120 years have suffered from a disease that infects Americans generally. We instinctively believe that law shapes culture when the usual pattern is the other way around. Nearly two centuries ago, de Tocqueville wrote that Americans turn all problems into legal problems. We seem to believe that all legal problems have solutions. We haven't changed much. Americans are incurable legal optimists. one reason why American Christians have behaved as we have is that we have been more American than Christian. That's why so many of us have believed that criminally prohibiting liquor or cocaine, gambling or abortion would actually put a stop to those practices when all the available evidence suggests otherwise. The second reason has less to do with religious believers than with institutional design. America's political system makes criminal laws easy to enact, and other kinds of legislation much harder. Criminal statutes require less work and attract less opposition than just about any other category of legislation. Americans suffer from too much criminal law for the same reason we burn too much gasoline, because both the laws and the gas cost too little. The reason criminal statutes are politically cheap is that they need not be enforced consistently, and almost never are. Criminal laws are like speed limits. They mean different things in different places, which makes it easy for politicians to vote for tough criminal sanctions because most of the time they know that those sanctions won't be applied to their constituents. That tendency has become more pronounced over time, which explains, I believe, the fact that drug punishments are so much more severe than the punishments doled out in the various vice wars of the early 20th century. The third answer matters most of all, I think. Christians in church communities like mine supported punitive policies because the policies didn't seem as punitive as they turned out to be. In part, the rise in punishment of the early 20th century and the even bigger rise in punishment of the late 20th century happened by design. Tough criminal laws were supposed to put more people in prison, and that's what happened. But no one expected it to happen in such massive measure. The politicians who wrote the laws, and even more so the voters who elected those politicians, had no idea what forces they were putting in motion. Many of those voters and at least some of those politicians were more interested in protecting vulnerable victims than in punishing wrongdoers. If you look at political debates surrounding gambling, prostitution, and liquor laws in the early 20th century and drug laws over the last 30 years, you see a lot of talk about victims, poor women forced into prostitution, factory workers tempted to gamble or drink their paychecks and thereby starve their families, school children lured into life-destroying drug addiction. The rhetoric is very similar to the rhetoric of the pro-life movement, which really was and is pro-life. It's about saving lives, primarily, not punishing evil. Punitive policies often begin with paternalist goals. So why do those policies wind up being so incredibly punitive? The answer is because the policies are imposed on their targets. They don't arise out of relationship with their targets. Here's what I mean by that. In most American cities in 1890 or 1900, the police officers who worked the streets of high-crime city neighborhoods lived in those neighborhoods. The local prosecutors who filed criminal charges were chosen by political machines that depended on the votes of residents of those neighborhoods. Local juries chosen from among those same residents decided which young men to send to prison. And locally elected trial judges selected by those same political machines decided for how long to send them. Criminal justice was an exercise in neighborhood-level self-government, which means that criminal punishment was embedded in relationship. Everyone knew everyone else. Criminals, crime victims, cops, and jurors all lived side by side. Anger at crime was tempered by empathy toward criminal defendants. They weren't abstractions, they were neighbors. You hesitate before you send your neighbor's kid to the state penitentiary. Not surprisingly, state penitentiaries had few inmates. Today's system is very different, in large part because of the politics of vice. Pressure for tough vice laws always comes from outside the neighborhoods where the laws are enforced most aggressively. The police officers who enforce those laws never live where they work. The laws themselves are written in ways that encourage guilty pleas. There are very few jury trials in drug cases, as there were few such trials in gambling and prostitution and liquor cases a century ago. Drug sentencing is usually governed by rules written by legislators or sentencing commissions, not by the discretionary decisions of locally elected trial judges. Criminal justice is no longer something crime-ridden neighborhoods do for themselves. Rather, it's something people in other neighborhoods do to them. When you divorce punishment from relationship, when you separate justice from empathy, justice inevitably takes on a more severe cast, as it has over the past century, and especially over the past generation. The government has two main tools for fighting crime: more prison beds, or more police officers on city streets. The first tool destroys relationship. The second creates opportunities for it. A generation ago in the United States, there were twice as many cops as prison inmates. Today, there are twice as many prison inmates as cops. That's what happens when criminal justice ceases to be something local neighborhoods do for themselves. If there is one core mistake my religious community has made in our approach to the justice system and to the politics that surrounds it, I think it's this. We've been far too willing to support rules and policies designed not for ourselves and our own neighborhoods, but for others who live in neighborhoods far removed from our own homes. That's often a bad way to do politics. It's a terrible way to do criminal justice. Last question. How might it all have been different? The sad thing is, I think it might have been very different indeed. When the culture war that is now coming to an end was just beginning, it might have taken as its model not the vice wars of the early 20th century, but another very different and much more successful culture war, the battle for civil rights for African Americans, the culture war that was fought mostly by black Protestants rather than by white ones. Notice the relationship between that battle and legal punishment. Today, we would expect the civil rights movement to try to make the architects and overseers of Jim Crow pay for the evil they did. Yet, for the most part, they didn't pay. There was no damages claim attached to Brown versus Board of Education, no reparations bill attached to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, no massive criminal punishments trailing in the wake of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The large majority of those who went to jail because of the civil rights movement were those who were seeking civil rights, not those who were trying to deny them. Martin Luther King's movement rested on a very simple, very strange, and very Christian idea, the idea that sacrifice, unmerited suffering, produces reconciliation. And reconciliation, not retribution, was King's goal. Think about the two great legal victories of King's movement, the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts passed in the mid-1960s. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 created the law of employment discrimination, which gave us an integrated economy in which blacks and whites can work side by side. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 created the modern law of voting rights, which gave us an integrated political community in which blacks and whites can vote side by side. It's so familiar, we've come to take it for granted, and yet it's an astonishing idea. King fought and bled and ultimately died for the right to have relationship with those who refused relationship with him. He didn't seek to punish, though he had every excuse and every right to seek precisely that. He wanted his enemies' embrace. It's an utterly captivating vision, and it changed the culture. I grew up south of the Mason-Dixon line in the 1960s. I remember that world well. As great as our failures have been in the last generation, and they are great, as true as it is that many of the promises made have yet to be fulfilled, and that is plainly true, even so, the scope of the change King wrought is staggering, and he did it all without putting anyone in prison. by and large, I think law can do three things. It can punish wrongdoing, it can relieve suffering, and it can promote and protect and sometimes create relationship. The culture wars of the early and late 20th century focused on the first of those three roles. King's culture war focused on the second and third. King got it right, and my generation of American Protestants has gotten it badly wrong. The last few weeks, I've spent many hours watching Ken Burns' series on World War II, as I'm sure some of you have. It's a striking film, and what most strikes me about it is the contrast in it. On the one hand, Burns shows the unremitting horror of that war, and on the other hand, he shows the inspiration, the generosity, and above all, the unity that ran through all aspects of the American war effort. All wars are awful. And yet, that war was not only awful. It deserves the name it is often given by our popular culture. Truly, it was America's good war. I believe King's movement was America's good culture war, the one that was fought as such battles ought to be, aggressively and passionately and with deep commitment to principle, and yet also with love for those with whom the movement did battle. Call it the marriage of law and grace. Legal change helped produce social and cultural change, not by locking up evildoers, but by building the beginnings of an integrated national community. Abraham Lincoln, the historical leader whom King most resembles, would have understood. Lincoln fought a terribly bloody war, one memorialized by another, even better, Ken Burns' film. And yet, hard as he fought, Lincoln could not bring himself to hate those he fought. They are our countrymen, he liked to say. We should approach them with malice toward none and charity toward all. Famous words that define the spirit of the one who spoke them. That spirit has been too little evident in the culture wars of the recent past. King's spirit has been too little evident. Some might wish for an American future free of culture wars. I don't. I think these battles are worth fighting. But I do wish for good wars, the kind King fought, the kind in which we love our enemies, and fight for the chance to embrace them. Thank you very much.